Your Honor, Michael Scodro on behalf of CDK Global and Mr. Dillecrath represents the co-plaintiff Reynolds & Reynolds, and I will endeavor, I'll keep an eye on the clock to reserve 2 minutes of the 11 for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Could I ask the clerk to set the clock at 11 so we're working off the 11 so it's easier to see what you've got and what you don't have?
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you.
There we are. Good.
Thank you. And I will aim to discuss the contracts and takings clause and also field any questions the court may have regarding CFAA preemption and pendant appellate jurisdiction as well, Your Honors. Starting with the contracts clause at the outset, the Arizona auto dealers here have succeeded in achieving precisely what the contracts clause exists to prohibit, Your Honors. The Arizona law rewrites a specific provision in existing enforceable contracts in a manner that advances the parochial interests of a small subset in the marketplace. The plaintiff's contracts with their dealer clients prohibit any third-party access to the plaintiff's system, to their software, without plaintiff's permission. In contrast, the new Arizona law countermands that and requires the plaintiffs to permit, indeed to facilitate, the authorization by the dealers of any number of third-party integrators to access the plaintiff's systems, Your Honor, not only to access information and to retrieve information from those systems, but at the same time to write back, to add ones and zeros to those systems. This is no minimal alteration of the contractual obligation in the words of Allied Structural Steel. Rather, this goes to the very core of the contracts in these cases, namely the ability to sublease what is a multi-million dollar function in terms of data integration and collection on these systems. Now, the district court attempted to sidestep this obvious contradiction, this obvious effort at overturning a particular provision in these contracts by inventing a distinction between direct and indirect access to plaintiff software. But of course, that distinction exists nowhere on the face of the contract. Rather, as we point out in quoting the contract provisions on pages 5 and 6 of our opening brief, those contracts prohibit unauthorized access, period. And whether you define that using lay dictionaries or more technological definitions as laid out in our brief, all of those definitions easily encompass what's at issue here, namely the exchange of information, taking from and writing to our systems.
Okay, counsel, I mean, suppose we agree with you that, you know, that this law is a substantial impairment of your contractual interest. The Supreme Court has told us for you to win, you also have to show that it's not, you know, an appropriate and reasonable way of advancing a legitimate public purpose. And that test seems to be a fairly deferential look at the, you know, the legislature in the exercise of its prerogative to, you know, engage in economic regulation. So why does it fail that part of the test?
Thank you, Your Honor. It fails that part of the test readily here because there is no public purpose. Courts answering this question, courts that are endeavoring to distinguish between, on the one hand, laws that aim to advance parochial interests, even if, by the way, there is some incidental public benefit on the one hand, and laws that truly serve a broad social purpose, which is the standard on the other hand. In endeavoring to distinguish between the two, courts typically begin with legislative findings that identify the purpose and try to link that purpose to the end goal identified and explain why the law advances that goal. Well, we have none of that here. And so instead, we're left with two things. One, we have the title of the statute, which speaks in terms of data secrecy, data privacy, Your Honor, and security. But on this record, it is implausible to suggest that the provisions that are challenged here, provisions that require a huge number of new access points to software systems, it is implausible to suggest that that somehow meaningfully advances the goal of data security. And it comes as no surprise, ultimately, Your Honor, that plaintiffs' experts are unwilling to say that. Andrew is willing to say that at the end of the day, perhaps it is security neutral, the provision that we're talking about. And their other expert, Mr. Kesterson, is willing to say, he acknowledges that by adding more people more entities that are accessing the system. There are risks involved, but he offers certain mitigation, certain mitigating factors. But none of that comes close to suggesting that this affirmatively advances, that the provisions we challenge affirmatively advance security. So then defendants say, well, as to this provision, perhaps it can be defended not on a security basis, but as pro-competitive in the marketplace. But here there's absolutely nothing in the record to suggest that the Arizona legislature included this provision and changed the sort of leveled the playing field, to use a word that the Eighth Circuit recently used in striking down a contract not so different in North Dakota in 2019. To level the playing field, there's nothing to suggest that that there was anything else at work. Indeed, the only bit of evidence we have from the legislative history, which is fairly scant and is spread out over pages 1181 to 1204 in the excerpts of record, all we have there is a single lobbyist for the Arizona Dealers Association. And she, quite frankly and candidly, advances a purely parochial interest on the part of auto dealers that they don't want to be paying for integration, or don't want their vendors to be paying for the integration as they agreed to in their existing contracts. So the only bit of evidence that does exist on the record points squarely in the direction of this being an effort to advance a purely parochial interest on the part of auto dealers in the state of Arizona, Your Honor.
Do you think that the state needs to come up with evidence of what the legislature's actual motive was, or is it enough to uphold the law for us to find that a conceivable purpose of it is a legitimate one?
Well, Your Honor, the law is clear that this is not rational basis. And indeed, the North Dakota case, the Eighth Circuit, to which I referred a moment ago, which also involved dealers, and is, as I say, I think a squarely on point in terms of this case, makes very clear that, and the standard itself as articulated by the Supreme Court in terms of a legitimate and significant public purpose that is being necessarily advanced by the law, is a far cry from rational basis. So in answer to Your Honor's question, the cases allow courts to infer from the face of the statute what may be the purpose, but whereas here, there are no such findings, and this was a problem encountered by the Eighth Circuit in its decision as well, Your Honor. Whereas here, there is nothing on the face. All we have to go on at this point is we have a provision advanced by a narrow group that is directly...
Can I interrupt for just a minute? But on this very point, are you saying that the effect of this statute will not be to increase competition? Are you denying that it increases competition?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, what it creates...
How can you deny that increased competition? It allows other integrators to come in, offer a lower price than you're offering. That sounds like competition to me.
Sure. Two quick points on that, Your Honor. First, by requiring us to provide something that we have devoted and invested tens of millions of dollars into at direct cost, and Mr. Dillicrath may speak to what exactly that means, which is a vague term. But whatever it means we're not permitted to recoup profits. We would be subsidizing the market that Your Honor describes by providing this to the marketplace, all of the work having been done at cost. And so that is not promoting an efficient market. It's actually requiring us to provide our services at drastically below market prices. And I should add that
so far I've not heard you deny that this increases competition. I've heard you complain that it's going to cost you some money.
Your Honor, by requiring us, it is not promoting competition. It's unclear what will happen here, frankly, but by requiring us to give up the restrictions on sublicenses that are embedded in our contracts, there is no reason to believe this would be a more competitive market. We would be providing these services at cost. You already have other DMS providers like the plaintiffs here who are already competing with us. The record in this case shows that combined the plaintiffs are about 65% of auto dealers in Arizona. So you have other other DMS providers who may be offering and often are a different bargain. That is, they do not put a restriction on sublicensing these systems. And so the competition exists. By requiring one party to subsidize the market at cost, there's no reason to believe that will create an efficient market. And I realize I'm eating into potential rebuttal time. If I
you may want to save at this point.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Dillicrath.
May it please the court, Tom Dillicrath on behalf of Reynolds and Reynolds. Section 106 of the Copyright Act provides copyright holders the right to reproduce copyrighted acts, to distribute copies, and to prepare derivative works. And that's in order to effectuate the purposes of the statute, which are to encourage the creation of original works by giving authors certain exclusive rights in those works and protecting their economic interests. There are three separate and independent ways in which the Arizona dealer law conflicts with and is therefore preempted by the Copyright Act. First, the use of the open API method required by the statute causes a copy to be created in the memory of plaintiff's computers. Second,
is there anything in the record that tells us how long a copy exists?
No, Your Honor, there is nothing in the record that speaks to that. That was not an issue that was raised below by defendants. And the case law, if you look at MAI, which specifically deals with copying of software into RAM in a very similar manner, held that it does constitute a copying without regard to the temporal nature of it. There was some discussion, for example, in Cartoon Networks, which is a out-of-circuit case, about the temporal element of copying. There, it dealt with buffering of a movie that was being downloaded or a television program. And there, I think, as we all know, if you've ever tried to download a movie, that buffering is very short. It's a matter of seconds, and there was a factual record on that.
So I just want to make sure I'm clear. So your client has the burden here. And so your position is that there's existing authority that demonstrates that you don't have to talk about how long the copy exists, even though the definition includes a temporal aspect to it.
Well, I think, Your Honor, MAI does hold to that effect, that where you're talking about the copying of into RAM, as we are here, that the Ninth Circuit has held that that is sufficient to constitute a sufficient amount of time for an infringement without having that discussion of the temporal element. And I mean, if you consider the type of copying that might take place here, an authorized integrator could run 24/7 under the law if they want, which would certainly increase the amount of time that would be held in the memory of the RAM. So there's no specific discussion in the record, but as a matter of basic computer science, I think you could argue that there is a significant amount of time that would be involved, even for the most basic of queries, but certainly allowable under the law. But this is not an issue that was raised until the, I'm not sure if it was a footnote or in the body of the text of defendant's briefing here. It was nothing that was raised in the briefing below.
Can your clients comply with the statute and the access that's required without allowing copying by the others?
No, Your Honor, they cannot, and in three separate ways.
I thought the district court held otherwise.
Well, I think that's one of the errors the district court made, Your Honor, and the errors were primarily legal errors. And what the district court did, Your Honor, was, I think, apply the wrong standard to one of the three ways in which we are alleging that copying would take place. The court looked only at the issue of copying of the API. And there, Your Honor, what happens is the API and the integrator need to be speaking the same computer language. So there are certain, I think the defendants refer to it as syntax, if I'm not mistaken. Mr. Kesterson, their expert, and it's in their brief as well. So that syntax needs to be copied between the two computers, and that would include things like field names and instructions on how the computer is to operate. And what the court did, Your Honor, was, I believe it only looked at the issue of whether there would be visibility to the third-party integrator, rather than looking on whether a copy would be made, which is really the salient issue under the Google Oracle case. And this is very similar to that. While Google Oracle spoke specifically about declaring code and the structure, sequence, and organization, the type of information that would need to be copied is very similar here. And to give a concrete example, Your Honor, a hypothetical one, if an integrator wanted to do a poll of all Mercedes that were purchased in Phoenix, serviced at a dealership, had the tires rotated and oil changed, they would need to copy the field names, which are a creative element that were captured by Reynolds or CDK, along with an instruction, could be SER or FIN, whatever. There's a number of alternatives they could choose from. And that's an important aspect of the Google Oracle case. There's a creative element in choosing the field names, in choosing the instructions, and in combining that. And that's the copy that has to be made.
But why aren't those, I mean, in Google or in Oracle, I mean, Google was wanted to copy the declaring code so that developers could use, you know, Java in its environment. And it seems like what's happening here is not sort of copying the whole declaring code. It's just using elements of it that are basically functional elements. Like you have to use them in order to ask for those particular pieces of information that you're asking for and in order to make the API work. That seems like a distinction from what was going on in Oracle, if I'm understanding the technology correctly.
I'm not sure. Well, I think you're right to a certain extent, Your Honor, in that the elements that are copied are used as part of the access of the through the API. But there's still a copy being made, and that's really the salient point under Google and Oracle. Is there a protectable, copyrightable interest, and is there a copy being made? And I think it's the case that that's factually correct, and as a matter of law, Google talks about, are there alternative choices available in the sort of organization that's made? And the type of declarations that were at issue in Oracle are very similar, to the example I just gave. I believe there, the one they cited was, it was MX and then parentheses, and it was like one integer and another integer, is it greater than the other? And that's really functionally exactly what you would be doing here is a query and then a series of identifiers or field names. You can call it syntax, as Mr. Kesterson did. You can call it sequence structure and organization. I think it's close to the declarations that were at issue in Oracle. But is there a copy being made of those elements? Are they a creative choice? That's really the keys. Whether the purpose of why it's being accomplished is not really anything that's covered by the copyright laws. It's the fact that a copy is being made. And let me speak briefly to the third category, Your Honors, and that is the data compilation that's being made. And it's inherent in the broad nature of the definition of protected dealer data that data compilations are available to the authorized integrator. And Mr. Andreu described the definition as a catch-all, which means that all of the data that goes in can come out. There's creative choices made and how that information is compiled. It includes potentially data that's put in there by plaintiffs, so that it's certainly entitled to protection by the copyright laws. And I'd refer the court to Experian Info Solutions, which held that even a list of names correlated with addresses is entitled to protection. Here it's far broader than that. Your Honors, I'm running low on time. I'm happy to answer any questions on vagueness. Otherwise, we can submit that on the papers, and I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Okay. Why don't you reserve, and you'll have a little chance to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And on the other side, we've got Mr. Ho and Mr. Roysden, 15 minutes and five. I'm not sure the order in which you wish to speak. Up to you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Derek Ho from Kellogg Hansen for the Arizona Automobile Dealers Association. I'll be going first. And we're happy to have the clock just be set at 20, and I'll try to keep track of the time that way, unless the court prefers otherwise.
No, it's easier for me if it's 15. There we go. So it's
okay.
Just counting 15.
Very well. May it please the court. The Arizona dealer law protects consumers and competition by preventing companies that store dealer data from holding that data hostage for their own financial gain. The district court correctly rejected plaintiffs' facial pre-enforcement attempt to to use implied preemption and the Constitution to shield themselves from classic economic legislation. I was planning to take the Copyright Act issue first, although my friends took it in the opposite order. And on the Copyright Act issue, I think it's important to emphasize that this is not express preemption. The Copyright Act, of course, has an express preemption provision. This is not impossibility preemption. This is implied preemption. And it's a facial challenge. So the very limited inquiry that this court has to engage in is there anything on the face of the Arizona dealer law that conflicts with something on the face of the Copyright Act? And I think the district court was quite right in saying that the answer to that question is clearly no. There is nothing on the face of the Copyright Act that prevents states from enacting what is ordinary economic legislation akin to data portability and interoperability legislation. Nothing, and looking at it from the other side, nothing in the Arizona dealer law expressly authorizes copying, distribution, the creation of derivative works. On the face of the two statutes, and that's what the Supreme Court encourages this court to look at in the context of implied preemption, there simply is no conflict between the two statutes. And I think the district court really could have ended its analysis there. Instead, it went on to, I would say, indulge the plaintiff's attempt to create a different kind of facial challenge. And that kind of facial challenge is to argue that there is no way that they can comply with the law without allowing an abridgment of their exclusive rights under the Copyright Act. I question whether that is an appropriate mode of analysis under for purposes of a facial implied preemption challenge, for the reason that Justice Kennedy's opinion in Arizona against the United States gave, which is that in essence, the exercise that the plaintiffs are asking the court to engage in is to speculate about all of the different ways in which the law might be implemented, and then to try to ask the negative. In other words, is there some way that we can, are all of the ways that we can conceive of ways that would require an act of infringement under the Copyright Act? I don't, that is a mode of analysis more what suited to an as-applied challenge. But the district court engaged it in any way and found the plaintiff's evidence wanting. And the district court was absolutely right about that. The plaintiffs did not prove that there is no way to comply with the law without allowing a violation of their exclusive rights. They cite three copyrighted works. One is the DMS software, which they say they would have to load into their internal RAM on their own systems in order to respond to an API request. There are three reasons that that proof didn't succeed. One, as the district court held, their proof they did not actually prove that they have to create new copies to respond to an API request. In footnote 8 of the district court's opinion, the court concluded that what Mr. Hall said at the trial was not sufficient to establish that point. All he said was that Reynolds's system, as it's currently designed, would load a copy of the software into RAM. He did not say or even attempt to prove that the only way one could design an API is to have a new copy be uploaded into RAM. And to the contrary, defendants' technology, a computer expert, Coy Kesterson, testified at length that that isn't necessary. You can use existing copies of the software that are already uploaded into RAM, because after all, this is software that is being used by many other people on a routine basis, including the dealers that license it. You can use already existing copies if you want to design the system that way to respond to the API request. So no copy has to be made whatsoever. That's what the district court found. That's not clear error. Two, even if it were true that plaintiffs would have to make a new copy, it's plaintiffs that would be making the copy, not the API users. And under the very volitional act doctrine that the plaintiffs cite in their reply brief, The question of who makes the copy is a question of who selects the content. And we didn't have a chance to respond to this point because it was made in their reply brief. So I would commend to the court Justice Scalia's decision in the Aereo case, where he explains at length the notion of what a volitional act is. And what he explains, and this isn't controversial, it's not the part of the decision that was controversial. A volitional act requires that someone be the person who selects the content. In other words, you decide whether you're targeting copyrighted work or non-copyrighted work. Here, the evidence at the hearing was absolutely clear that the user of an API has no ability to dictate whether the API responder copies anything in terms of software into RAM, what software it copies. It has no ability to dictate whatsoever how the API responds to the request. So under the volitional act doctrine, it is not correct to say that the API user is making a copy. If anyone is making a copy, even on plaintiff's own theory, it is plaintiffs themselves. And a law that says that you have to make a copy of your own work does not violate the exclusive rights that the Copyright Act confers on copyright owners as a matter of federal law, because that right of exclusivity is a right to exclude other people from copying or reproducing or distributing. And MAI, which is the central case on which plaintiffs rely, has nothing to say about that, because it was undisputed there that the repairmen were the ones who were making the copy, not MAI itself. So there was no question of...
I'm not sure I totally agree with that one. Even if it is the plaintiffs who are making the copy, if, as they allege, they are making the copy because they are required to do so, and they are making the copy for the benefit of others, that sounds as though they're not just making the copy because they want to for their own purposes. So I'm not sure that the fact that they're making the copy themselves is by itself determinative.
Well, Judge Fletcher, I think that with respect to Copyright Act preemption, it is determinative, because the only exclusive right that they say is infringed is the exclusive right to make a copy. And if no one else is enabled by the law to make such a copy, that exclusive right is not being infringed. Now, it may be that their making of the copy does have benefits, economic benefits for other people, but the Copyright Act doesn't protect copyright owners against all potential uses of copyrighted works, even uses that might have economic benefits to the user. It limits the protection to the enumerated exclusive rights, copying, reproduction, distribution, creation of derivative works. So I think it is correct that if nobody else, if all that happens is that they effectively are told you need to make a copy of your own software on your own systems, that is not a violation is not inconsistent with Section 106. And then the third reason that their proof fails is the reason that I think may have underlaid Judge Hunsaker's question, which is there is another element of copyright infringement or of what a copy requires that plaintiffs never even attempted to prove. And that is that any copying into internal RAM would have to be, again, necessarily, in order for them to comply with the law, would necessarily have to be non-transitory. There was no proof of that whatsoever, no effort even to prove that. And so for all three of those reasons, the district court, even on the assumption that you can analyze a facial implied preemption challenge in this way, did not abuse its discretion in holding that plaintiffs had failed to show a substantial likelihood. On the API declaring code, there are two elements of the Copyright Act that are presumed undisputed in Google against Oracle that again, they made no effort to prove in this case. And that is that originality and creativity. In Google against Oracle, no question, it's not disputed that Sun's API was both original and creative. But here, again, what the district court found was that the law doesn't even require that plaintiffs use their own declaring code. In fact, Reynolds, the evidence at trial was that Reynolds just borrows declaring code from Star, the standards for technology and automotive. And so they don't even have to use their own code, which is, of course, the originality requirement. Second, even if they did have to use their own code, they don't have to use creative code. At the Supreme Court oral argument in Google, the analogy was raised of the QWERTY keyboard that arguably is creative. But a keyboard that just says A, B, C, D, E, F, G would not be creative. That's Feist. Nothing in the dealer law says that you have to use creative declaring code. Nothing says that Reynolds or CDK have to use the wonderful creative declaring code that they currently use in their current APIs. If they want to, they can use the equivalent of an A, B, C, D, E, F, G keyboard. And there are lots of declaring codes out there, like the Star declaring codes, that are not creative at all. Get open paren vin end paren might be something that would cause the computer to get a VIN number. There's nothing creative about that. And so for both of those reasons, again, the plaintiffs just did not prove that they could not comply, that nobody could comply with the law without conflicting with the purposes of the Copyright Act. Let me turn to the contracts clause in my remaining time. One, we do think that the district court was correct in finding, as a matter of fact, that there was no impairment, not to mention a substantial impairment of the contract. And the reason that he found that was the evidence was crystal clear at the hearing that an API allows a user to obtain data without ever obtaining access to a system. That is the whole raison d'etre of an API. And so their contracts, which say no third party can obtain access to the system, is not infringed, because access in this context is reasonably interpreted to mean a physical intrusion onto the system, just as that term is used in the CFAA. And I know that Mr. Scodro says that he thinks that the contract ought to be construed more broadly, but clearly access can be construed in that narrower way. And I think the district court was correct on, again, a facial challenge where there is a presumption of constitutionality to construe the contract in the narrower way against the drafter, where there is an ambiguity in what access means, whether, again, it's physical intrusion or some broader notion. So the district court, I think, didn't abuse its discretion or commit clear error in finding no impairment. And then as to the second step of the analysis, it's plaintiff's burden to show that there is no significant purpose. That's a difference between this circuit's law and the law of the Eighth Circuit. So the Eighth Circuit case that they rely on so heavily just isn't good law in this circuit. But at any rate, there was ample evidence presented to the district court of that purpose. We had an expert that had decades in the industry explaining how important it was to make sure that DMS companies could not monopolize this data, as they tried to do after decades of acknowledging that anybody should be able to obtain it freely. We had a fact witness from another DMS company that explained how all the negative consequences of this kind of data hostage taking. We had the declaration of Ms. Sparrow, who was one of the architects of the bill, explaining the impact of this on dealers. To Judge Miller's question, it is purpose and not motive that's the issue. So the fact that there were no legislative findings is really neither here nor there. At any rate, the panel has an amicus brief from the state of Montana, which has a parallel law. They did have legislative findings precisely on the pro-competitive effects and the importance of those pro-competitive effects. And frankly, those pro-competitive effects are apparent from the face of the law, as Judge Fletcher suggested. And Mr. Scodro ended, I think, by saying that he's not sure whether the law will be pro-competitive or anti-competitive. Well, that is precisely why, under the Contracts Clause, this court ought to defer to the legislative judgment of the state of Arizona, of Oregon, of Montana, of the other states that have enacted this law, and rather than striking this law down.
Thank you, Mr.
Royston. Over my time, and my apologies to Mr. Royston if I've eaten into it. If the court has no further questions, I will turn it over to him.
I will save you from any disagreement with Mr. Royston by putting 5 minutes on the clock for him.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Mr. Royston, to you.
May it please the court, Solicitor General Beau Royston on behalf of Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich. I realize it's late in the day, and I do not anticipate taking up my entire time unless the court has questions. I would like to briefly focus on three issues. First, the states have a strong interest in passing laws such as the dealer data law to regulate their marketplaces and protect their consumers and data privacy. Two other states in this circuit, Montana and Oregon, have enacted their own dealer data laws, and this law in Arizona passed unanimously in both our House and Senate. Second, the pre-enforcement challenge is particularly inappropriate here because there are many lawful ways that the state can enforce this law. Appellants' attempt to cut off any enforcement is improper, and instead, issues can and should be resolved in as-applied challenges to any enforcement action. Third, many of appellants' arguments, if adopted, would lead to absurd results and tie the state's hands in passing legislation to regulate their respective marketplaces as we transition to a digital economy. For example, appellees read the CFAA as precluding any sort of consumer protection or data privacy regulation by the states if it requires a system to interact with third parties. Similarly, appellants allege that it would be a taking to require a commercial database to store even one bit of data by an authorized user. With that, I will sum up by saying, as I see this as a representative of the state, this is really about our ability to regulate a distinct system. We are not going inside the system. We're simply saying allow the system to be interoperable with a separate system. I don't think plaintiffs have met any of their constitutional preemptive challenges here. I think the district court was correct to deny their preliminary injunction.
Can I ask you just a question about the jurisdictional argument in your brief? I think it's the CFAA and vagueness arguments were not addressed by the court in ruling on the PI because they had already been dismissed. And you say we don't have jurisdiction to consider them, but they were in the motion for a PI, and the order is one denying that motion. So why aren't they necessarily part of the order, even if the court didn't say anything about them individually?
Correct. We think procedurally, because the court issued two different orders and first denied them in the motion to dismiss before reaching the PI, you know, it set the table for the PI, and the court's appellate jurisdiction is kind of based on what table the district court set. But if the court disagrees and thinks that it can reach those, I think we feel very comfortable that neither the CFAA nor vagueness justified a preliminary injunction in this case, Your Honor.
Okay. Any further questions from the bench? Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Scodro will put 2 minutes on the clock for you, and Mr. Dillicrath the same, two minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Let me just address a couple of the points raised by Your Honor and also by Mr. Ho. There is nothing, to be clear, there is nothing pro-competitive, indeed it's anti-competitive, to require someone who, a party who has invested tens, hundreds of millions of dollars in a system, in a method of organization, only to require them to provide it into the marketplace at cost without a return on their investment. And that's what's being demanded here. When I said, I think Mr. Ho has it backwards. When I said, we don't know what will happen, the fact of the matter is what I meant is there are no legislative findings, even identifying a market needing rectifying under these circumstances. We don't know whether it's going to be the third party vendors who will simply take this at cost. Will there be other integrators? The fact of the matter is, to the extent there is a need for any competition in this space, it already exists. The competition is between DMS providers like plaintiffs here who choose not to permit sublicensing and charge accordingly of their dealer clients, and those other nearly half the market in Arizona that do the opposite and that take a different approach and charge accordingly because they do provide a sublicense. It would be as if Westlaw were a state law were passed such that my firm could give out Westlaw passwords to third-party entities, and they would, and Westlaw would only be able to charge them at cost. That would not be pro-competitive because Westlaw would not be receiving the return on the investment in organizing the data in the manner that we have invested to do so here. On top of all this, as I said, there are no findings by the legislature. When counsel was asked for the defendants by the district court, what evidence is there that there's this pro-competitive motivated the legislature? The response was, we'd have to look at Bobby Sparrow's testimony.
Okay, that's your 2 minutes if you would like to sum up.
Thank you, Your Honor. And just to conclude, Bobby Sparrow is the aforementioned lobbyist. We would urge the court to look at the legislative history that's provided, particularly page 1186. And the Eighth Circuit's recent decision in equipment manufacturers, we can clearly establish that as a matter of law, the contracts, we're entitled to judgment on the contracts clause as well as the takings claims and the other claims raised, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dillicraft. You're
muted.
My apologies. Thank you, Your Honor. Just three quick points. First, Your Honor, I think the legal standard urged by my friend Mr. Ho and apparently undertaken by the court below falls into precisely the issue and problem identified in U.S. v. Arizona. And that is that they assume that the law is not preempted on its face and then point out allegedly constitutional applications of a statute that conflicts with congressional intent and therefore is preempted by the Supremacy Clause. And I think it's a fundamental misreading of Salerno to assume that one can engage in invoking counterfactuals and using those to demonstrate that a law is valid under the Supremacy Clause. And that's not what happened here. Second, Mr. Ho brought up the Aria case. And while I think Justice Scalia's dissent is interesting, it doesn't change the notion of volitional conduct. The volitional conduct test, and you could see it in the injunction in MII, who causes the copy to be made, as I believe Judge Fletcher pointed out. There is someone causing this copy to be made. Reynolds has no interest, CDK has no interest in making this copy, but for the third-party integrator causing it to happen. So I think the precedent is well established that it's the individual or the entity that's causing the copy to be made that matters. The final notion that I would bring up, Your Honor, is the creativity and originality of the APIs. There is testimony in the record. It's at ER 308 and 309. It's Mr. Hall's testimony. And, Your Honor, I know Mr. Ho indicated that the judge did not find Mr. Hall's testimony compelling as to a particular point in footnote 8. I think what he said is it's insufficient to prove a point that was not a point that should have been at issue, that was a legal error by the judge in assessing the wrong point. So I think, Your Honor, we believe our copyright claim is strong in the three separate and independent areas that I've identified and urge the court to reverse the lower court's decision. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. Thank all sides for very useful arguments. The case of CDK Global versus Branovich is now submitted for decision, and that completes our arguments for this afternoon, indeed for the week. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court for this session stands adjourned.